So, first of all, thank you for being here. The topic I wish to tell you about today, rotational super radiance and black hole instabilities, in this case of scalar fields, is quite an old topic, and it's quite rich. It dates all the way back to the likes of Wheeler and Penrose. And in many ways, some of the papers I'm going to tell you about today were sort of the precursor of Hawking radiations in the Hawking papers in the 70s. So it was for a long time a GR topic, but in the last decade or so, it's seen a sort of renaissance in the astrophysics and astroparticle and particle physics community, and hopefully you'll know why that is today. So my presentation is going to go this way. First of all, I want to talk about super radiant scattering of a rapidly rotating dissipative media. What's great about super radiance is even though its most sort of potent form is has to do with black holes and specifically rotating black holes, it's actually a very simple idea that has classical analogs that you can build an understanding. Then I'm going to move on to super radiant scattering of specifically rotating black holes and then draw the distinction between super radiant scattering and super radiant instabilities. And if time permits, I'll go as in the particle physics application of super radiance. So what is super radiance? The first line of the review paper I'm reading right now is super radiance is a radiation enhancement process that involves dissipative systems. And so how does that work? Well, as I said, it's possible to build a very an intuitive understanding of super radiance from very simple intuitions. So we can derive that thing called the super radiant condition that is central to super radiance just from Newtonian mechanics. So if you imagine a Newtonian point particle that is tangentially incident on a big rotating cylinder made of rough material so that there's friction at the point of contact, and you just do your Newtonian analysis, conservation of energy and total momentum, and you get that the particle, as it leaves, as it sort of whizzes by the cylinder, is going to extract energy and angular momentum from the rotating cylinder if things are such that the initial angular velocity of the particle is smaller than the initial angular velocity of the cylinder, so that it gets a boost as it passes by. And that is, that would be our super radiant condition. Now, of course, we want to move on to a wave analysis, and we can think about the same problem, that is scalar perturbation, scalar waves, incident on a rotating cylinder that is made of a dissipative medium with constant of dissipation alpha. Those can be, as I said, it's a classical effect. It works with water waves, sound waves, pressure waves, but in this case, it's just a scalar field that we decompose based on this, intuitive ensatz. It's in its normal mode frequency and its angular momentum number, the projection along the axis, in this case, out of the board. And if we just were to translate our conditions on angular velocity, we could write this super radiant condition for a wave. That is little omega, which is the time frequency over m smaller than big omega. It's a very interesting argument. We can make sort of derive the same problem, but in a more in-depth way, looking at the equation of motion in a paper in 71 by Zeldovich, which, as I said, is the precursor to Hawking radiation, is sort of hinted at in this early paper. And so the idea is you can write the equation of motion for your scalar field. So if we imagine a massless scalar field that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation in a dissipative medium, so you have this dissipation term, and then the idea is to look at two frames, so the medium is moving, the prime coordinates are the rest frame of the medium, and the unprime coordinates would be those of an observer at rest. So you do your Lorentz transformation if you want to express the equation of motion in the unprime frame. The time derivative just transforms as the zeroth component of a four vector. And then Zeldovich says, well, this is a linear analysis, but we can imagine projecting, sort of wrapping up this linear dimension around the perimeter of our rotating cylinder, and then we have this simple dictionary as to how to relate the coordinates. We plug in our ansatz and the equation of motion. So the equation of motions in terms of those normal, the normal modes and the angular momentum frequency looks like this, where we recognize again the super radiant condition. And then the key thing is to realize is if we are in the superradian regime that is omega smaller than big omega m, that term is going to be negative, which means that effectively it's going to change the sign of that alpha parameter. So if alpha positive meant that the cylinder is absorbing in the dissipative system, once it flips signs in that regime, our absorber has now become an amplifier. And so that's the idea that waves scattering off the cylinders are going to be amplified. And you can actually solve this problem analytically, which I did for a cylindrical shell. And then you get your solutions. You can decompose them in ingoing and outgoing waves. And this is a plot of the amplification coefficient, the power in, power out over power in minus 1. And you can see that's for different absorption coefficient. And well, first of all, it's greater than 0, meaning we indeed have had amplification. This is the same kind of plot, but for different angular momenta of the wave. And we can see that the superradiance condition works as one would expect. There is superradiance until there's a shutdown when the superradiant condition is saturated, when the omega over little omega over big omega is larger than m. Another feature that is true of superradiance for black hole that we can glean from this example is the fact that if you have higher angular momentum numbers, you have a larger regime of superradiance, but the amplification sort of goes down. And also those numbers, this is in percentage, are quite modest. We're talking about 5% or such for cylinders that rotate quite fast. So then at some point in the paper, the idea, Zeldovich's idea is, well, superradiance require a rapidly rotating dissipative medium. Well, black holes are kind of perfect absorbers. So he conjectures, well, maybe that happens if I'm scattering waves off a rotating black hole. He says a similar situation can arise also when considering a rotating body in a state of gravitational relativistic collapse. The metric near such a body is described by the well-known Kerr solution. And so there's the idea that if you just have a Kerr spacetime, rotating spacetime, you're going to see superradiant scattering the same way as you see it of rotating cylinders. And then in the years following that, Press, Tucholsky, and Starobinsky worked that out, and turns out that you do get superradiant scattering. They produce the same sort of plot that I showed earlier for my toy model of scalar waves. They scattered ENM waves and gravitational waves of Kerr black holes. And then again, the amplifications are quite modest, only 4.4% for ENM wave. Gravitational waves, a little bit larger. But the important fact that I want to, the important takeaway here that I want you to remember is that superradiant scattering is this one-off effect. You have your Kerr black hole, you throw in radiation, it gets amplified by the black hole, and then it escapes to infinity, and you're sort of done. It's the end of the process. But then Press and Tucholsky figured out, well, what if we were to, again, they did this calculation for massless particles, right? So they were like, well, what if we were to enclose our black hole with a giant spherical mirror, right? That would force the photons to bounce around. So they would go in, be amplified once, and then bounce around and be amplified again, and then again, and again, and again. And so there would be repeated amplification, and the field would grow exponentially, and then they coined that term black hole bomb. And then the superradiant instability, as opposed to superradiant scattering, superradiant instability is this growth that is more than just like a one-off effect. And pretty soon people realize, well, nature sometimes provides its own mirror. Obviously, we can't build giant mirrors around black holes, at least not yet. But massive particles, very intuitively, massive particles are confined in orbits around black holes just from the 1 over r Newtonian potential far away from black holes. And so it turns out that indeed massive bosonic fields in Kerr geometries are unstable. That is, they will grow spontaneously and exponentially by extracting energy and angular momentum from the black hole, from spacetime. And the reason, so it works for bosons, massive bosons. It doesn't work for fermions because of Fermi-Dirac statistics, essentially. You can build massive numbers of particles in the same state because they're fermions. All right, so a little bit more detail. How do you solve that? This is an eigenvalue problem. You're seeking to solve the massive Klein-Gordon equation in curved spacetime. This is what it looks like. The nablas now are the covariant derivative in the curved geometry. Turns out to be separable. You make an ansatz like this, where you have this is in spherical coordinates. You have your angular momentum projection, your radial wave function, radial part of the field, and use the word wave function too liberally here. And then your boundary condition is you want an infalling wave at the black hole event horizon, and you want your solution to be regular at infinity. And then you're going to look for your eigenvalues, omega of the normal mode, just like you would in quantum mechanics. And you're going to find that you actually can't find a normal mode solution. You're going to find a quasi-normal mode, which is the frequency is going to have a small imaginary part. You can see from this time dependence that if omega is imaginary, then this oscillatory function becomes either a growing or decaying exponential. The decaying exponential makes a lot of sense because you expect if you throw something at a black hole, it's going to go in the black hole, sinking, and so you expect some sense. In some sense, there should be a regime in which you feel dies off. But again, from my example at the beginning, you can tweak the angular the relationship between omega and m such that you can get a growth and super radiance occurs. So this is a massive scalar, the Klein-Gordon equation in its full glory in the curved geometry. It is what it is. It involves the spin of the black hole. Those are the roots of the polynomials. One of them is the event horizon. It's not super enlightening, but the key here is to take a limit. You take the far, so you want to solve it in the far away from the black hole and then very close to the black hole event horizon. So in the far regime, that is at a radius much larger than half the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole, and also if you're looking for modes with small couplings in this case, would mean gravitational couplings, so the product of the masses, well, lo and behold, you recover the hydrogen atom equation, which is not so surprising, because when you're solving the hydrogen atom, you're essentially solving a scalar field and a 1 over r potential. So it's not surprising that as you go away from the black hole, the potential becomes a 1 over r. It doesn't essentially know it's a black hole. It could be a planet. And you recover the Schrodinger equation. So you know your solution, both the radial part and the angular part. Then you can do the same thing in the near regime. What we mean by near is that the wave at radius much smaller than the Compton wavelength of the particle in question. This is a plot of the effective potential, and as I said, you've got this far away from the black hole. It looks like a hydrogen atom. You've got this local minimum and then the kinetic barrier, and if that were the hydrogen atom, you'd be done, but of course it's a black hole. Eventually, gravity wins out. So it wins so much that actually the particle looks massless in this regime because the mass of the particle is not, its contribution to the potential is negligible compared to the depth of the well of the black hole. And so the trick is, if you are in the limit in which alpha over L, so alpha being the coupling, is much smaller than 1, then you are in this lucky region where there exists a regime where those two approximations, so the small r approximation for this function and the large r approximation, they actually overlap, and you can do an analytical matching. You can also, of course, solve this problem numerically. And so now we're interested into the super radiant growth rates. Again, the tuning parameter here is the fine structure constant of this gravitational atom, the product of the masses, which so that's in natural units. You can also think about it as the ratio of the Schwarzschild radius to the Compton wavelength of the particle. The quasi-normal modes, so as I said, your frequencies, well, the real part, unsurprisingly, turns out to be the hydrogen spectrum plus the rest mass of the particle, special relativity plus your hydrogen spectrum. And then interestingly, the imaginary part turns out to be, well, this expression, where the important things to note is, well, we recover the super radiant condition as the thing that controls the sign of this rate. And if it's positive, we're going to see growth. If it's negative, the perturbation is going to be dumped inside the black hole. Another thing to note is that it was readily noted by Dirtweiler when he first wrote this paper, that the largest growing level would be the analog of the 2p orbital in a hydrogen atom. And so those are the growth rates. The solid line, so the dashed lines are the growth rates for different values of AL obtained from the expression I just showed on the previous slide, the analytic matching. The solid lines is a numerical analysis. The line at the top, please don't pay attention to it. It's you can do something with the WKB approximation, but it's valid in another regime. What's important to see is, well, first, again, we can see the super radiance condition at play. Once alpha becomes too large, the energy becomes too large, or rather the spin of the black hole becomes too small. In any case, you're outside of their super radiance regime, so super radiance shuts down. It's also peaked roughly around values of alpha equals roughly the order of the unity. There's also some L dependence, of course. But what's important to see is, well, if alpha is too large, as I said, you shut down super radiance. If alpha is too small, you get rays that are so small that you don't expect to see anything happening within the lifetime of the universe. And so if we move to the phenomenology of the black hole scalar condensates, well, we don't get to pick and make our black holes, not yet. I mean, maybe one day we'll engineer black holes in the laboratory. That would be in the laboratory. But right now we have astrophysical black holes. So we have stellar black holes and supermassive black holes. Those are sort of just characteristic masses with their corresponding Schwarzschild radius. And if you want alpha to be of the order of the unity, or roughly in the order where you would have rates that would give you, small enough so that you would have super radiance, but large enough so that you would see it in the lifetime of the universe, that constrains the mass of the particle you're looking for, the scalar particle you're looking for, to be in those range. So 10 to the minus 10 approximately, and 10 to minus 18 or 20. So those are super so-called ultra-light bosons, much lighter than the electron, but critically not massless. As I said, if it were massless, you wouldn't have those bound states. I put the size of the clouds. It's the Bohr radius of this gravitational atom. People are going to talk about giant atoms in the sky because, if you want to think about it like that, those are really huge atoms in the sky. The rates, well, I put here, depends a lot on alpha, depends a lot on what level you're talking about, but the important thing is that, there's a range of things from the fraction of a day to 10 to the 7 years, so very large parameter space. But what's interesting is we're definitely going to see this within the lifetime of the universe and the lifetime of a black hole. And then just the number of particles that are going to be in this level by the end of super radiance is going to be order 10 to the 76, so massive numbers of particles. So the idea is, so this is a plot of the black hole mass as a function and its spin, and everything that is in blue is, if we give, I believe it's 10 to the 6 in this particular plot, say 10 to the 6 years for super radiance to happen, then any black hole that's born in one of the blue region with this mass and this spin is going to be sort of ejected out or pushed out of that region, is going to be spun down as angular momentum is subtracted from it inside this cloud of particles. So an extremal black hole with, I believe this is the mass of, they were considering it for the QCD axion, 10 to the minus 11 electron volt. If it's born extremal, in about 2 years, it would spin down and fill in this case, L equals 2, so 3D level. Then the super radiance would shut down, and then another level would start being filled, but at a much, much slower rate. And so the first way you can think about using black holes for particle discoveries in this case is, well, they modify what those are called Reggi plots, but or Reggi plot, I'm not quite sure. But they modify what the space of black hole mass versus split spin is going to be populated. If you don't have super radiance, or if you don't have super radiance at the right parameters, you expect black holes to be distributed sort of evenly along the spin axis. And then LIGO and our future gravitational wave detectors should allow us to produce plots like that. So each point represents a black hole. And then we should have a reasonable idea of what black holes in the universe look in terms of their mass and spin. Now, of course, if there is super radiance, as I said, the black holes are going to be pushed out within their lifetime out of a certain region. And so we expect the, you know, this chart to be populated in a much different way, depending on the, you know, depending on the mass of the underlying scalar particles. Another signal, and we're getting now into more of the recent work by Professor Arvanitaki. Another signal you expect is the gravitational wave emissions from those atoms in the sky. The same way as you can expect analogs of atomic transitions. In the same way as the atom, you have your electron transitioning and emitting photons. You expect those scalars to transition between atomic levels and emit gravitons. Also, if the scalar in question doesn't have any conserved quantum numbers that would prevent this from happening, you expect them to annihilate the gravitons. And so you expect gravitational waves to come from those atoms. And then finally, that's sort of the part of my project, of the project that I'm working on, is to understand the effect of self-interactions, scalar self-interactions on the condensate. So are thinking about particular particles well motivated theoretically, like the QCD axion, and how could we discover them with super radiance? As Fabian pointed out in his card, this is sort of, the QCD axion would be hard to discover because we expect it to be very light and very weakly coupled to the standard model. What's great about super radiance is that this was just a function of the mass of the particle. It doesn't have anything to do with the coupling. But we do expect the QCD axion to be, for example, a 5-4 theory, have self-interaction. Then the Klein-Gordon equation you're solving is no longer the massive Klein-Gordon equation. It's nonlinear. You have to solve it perturbatively. Your hydrogenic wave functions are no longer good Huygens states, good quantum numbers. And intuitively, you just expect, if this interaction is attractive, you expect the cloud to want to collapse. As it grows, super radiance makes it grow, but eventually they want to smush together. And so at the level of Feynman diagrams, you expect diagrams like this. So for example, you can have three axions in the cloud annihilating to a free, so I say axion because that's the particle they were considering, but three bound scalars annihilating to a free scalar, and then generating signals coming towards Earth. You can also have transitions between levels that come through this 5-4 vertex rather than the dipole transition of atomic transitions. All right, so summary and conclusion. Today I talked about rotational super radiance. It's a radiation enhancement process by which you can extract energy and angular momentum from black holes, or generally a rotating dissipative medium. Wave perturbations incident on a black hole are going to exhibit super radiance. An ultralight massive scalar field, if it exists in nature, would be unstable in a rotating curved spacetime. And these instabilities would allow us to infer the existence of particles from black hole, the measurements of black hole properties. All right, thank you very much. Yes, now?
So for these like atomic transitions, is there like, do you have like a energy range for what you expect to,
You do, I mean, they're, yeah, I don't have them in mind right now, but it's, it's the hydrogen, it's an hydrogenic transition, right? So it's literally the mass of the particle obviously doesn't change. So it depends on alpha. It's the Rydberg formula, essentially. To leading order, so I'm not quite sure what frequency that corresponds to, it's monochromatic, what's exciting is we could do spectroscopy in the same way as we did it at the beginning of the century for molecules, an atom, we could do it for those giant atoms if things like LIGO have a better precision.
I have just one, sorry for this question, but in one of your early slides where you have the EM and GW you said it was just over a bit. Was it sarcasm or a typo?
Was it, sorry? The 138?
Yeah.
No, it actually is 138. I thought it was a typo when I saw it in the talk. Why, you think it's large?
What?
You think it's large?
It's larger than the M.
It's larger than the M. Yes, that is correct.
It's like significantly.
That is correct. And the hierarchy in that is scalar EM tensors.
Okay.
And the reason is, so I've been working obviously only on scalars because that's the easiest case. Mina's group right now are working out the vector case. The reason is that this exponential changes from 4L to having to be something like 2L plus 2S, like the spin. Mm-hmm. There's a J, total angular momentum.
Okay.
And the idea is you can reach, for example, let me see if I can see. If you are at L equal zero, so you're going to get much bigger rates the closer your wave function is to the origin of the black hole, right?
Okay.
Now, the closest wave function is the L equals zero. Now, of course, if you don't have spin, L equals zero, you have M, it only goes to M equals zero, you're not going to get super radiance at all because the super radiant condition is never going to work. But if you have your spin there, you can be in an L equals zero wave function, still have your spin one, and now it's J that matters in this condition. So you can have super radians for waves that are much more closely packed to the center of the black hole. And that's why you see this hierarchy of super radians, of amplifications.
Okay, so in the end, when you're talking about the axion, so you can always get this sort of phenomenon if the particle is self-interacting?
You can get the hydrogenic structure and these transitions. Everything I've talked up to that point, you don't need self-interaction. No, you don't need self-interaction. Self-interaction actually complicates the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
There's this, because now the without self-interaction, there's a very clean separation between the time scales of those phenomena. As I said, in this regime, that level is still growing. Like, they're both growing at the same time. But as you can see from those timescales, essentially, that level is not growing at all while, this takes only 2 years, and this takes 10 to the 4 years, right? So the idea is, without self-interactions, you have a very clean decoupling between the levels, and you can predict very well your signals coming from, which levels are filled at which time. You can very well predict those transitions. If you have self-interactions, then you can have, depending on how strong this coupling is, you have this pathway that levels can, quote-unquote, cross-contaminate. Of course, you can see it as a blessing, too, because now they can emit waves, not only gravitational waves can come from the atom, but also scalar waves. So depending on how you want to see it, it's a good or a bad thing.
Why would you expect the QCD axiom to be self-interacting?
I have no clue. I just took that from the paper.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a thing that works for any scalar. Mina's paper, people have strong hopes that it's going to lead to the QCD axion being discovered. Because that's, what's great is it's a mechanism that looks for very weakly coupled stuff and which we wouldn't be able to see at colliders. So it's an interesting.
So but you would expect self-interaction, right? Because you basically, if you find that it's the potential coming from the integrating of the nuance in QCD, but you would basically get
But is that a 5-4?
Well, it's like a cosine theta, right?
All right. Well, I'm not. My knowledge of the QCD axion is not on point right now, so I can tell you.
Okay.
Yeah, Fabian?
Maybe we
should
pull it to a close.
Sorry. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I guess to sort of start off, I'll talk about signal processing, which is, I guess, where originally the whole idea of doing a discrete Fourier transform and the FFT came from and why you'd want to do these things in the first place. So signal processing, I guess, is a subfield of electrical engineering. It's very important. Basically, like any sort of data you can represent as a signal. So a signal is just a function of some sort of independent variable. Like say, if I want to describe the motion of an object, have the motion being a function of time, maybe. Or if I wanted to describe sound, for example, if I have an MP3 file or something like that, I might decide to store pressure as a function of time and where you're located in space. Or if I want to do image processing, I might store information like the brightness of the image, the color, pixel, or whatever. And so this information, that is your signal, can be either continuous or discrete. And in the case that we have discrete signals, we would call the separate points samples. And your signal can be either analog or digital. So an analog signal is real valued and continuous, and a digital signal is discrete in terms of both time and value. Okay, so signal processing broadly is just the field of, well, as the word processing implies, generating, modifying, extracting any sort of information from signals. And so generally, you would work either in the time domain or the frequency domain. And so you'd want to be able to Fourier transform between the two. So people do things like usually they collect the signal in terms of time. They Fourier transform, and then they do things like apply a high-pass filter or a low-pass filter or a band-pass filter in the frequency domain, and then other kinds of processing, perhaps, and then they would just go back to time domain. So that is, I guess, sort of the motivation for the discrete Fourier transform, and that gives us our definition of the discrete Fourier transform. So like, let's say you have a bunch of discrete samples, x of n. You could use either n or t, but I think people who do this kind of thing use n. And you would Fourier transform to get to the frequency domain x of k. And so that's just what it is, the formula for it right there. It looks pretty similar to a continuous Fourier transform, which you're sort of used to doing in physics, I guess. And then if you want to go the other way around, so going from frequency domain back to the time domain, you would just take the inverse discrete Fourier transform, which looks like that. So it looks very similar, right? So now I guess I'll talk about the fast Fourier transform, which is basically a classical algorithm. It's a fast way of computing a discrete Fourier transform. So naively, from the definition of a discrete Fourier transform, you would think that it would maybe take n squared time to do, right? Because you have the sum where you run over n terms, and then you need to do this n times for your endpoints. So the fast Fourier transform algorithm lets you do this in O of n log n time. So that's a pretty big speed up. It's nice. And so roughly, I guess, the statement of what it does is, let's say you have these two vectors. First one we'll call A. You have A naught to A n minus 1, so it has n components. Second one we'll call B, so it's B naught to B n minus 1. And basically what it does is it computes the convolution A star B. So the first element of that is A naught B naught, and then you have A naught B1 plus A1 B naught, and so on. So basically your indices in the kth position, your indices sum to k. So that's a convolution. And so a question might be, why would it be useful to be able to do this? Well, first of all, this is basically the definition of polynomial multiplication, right? If you consider each vector to be the coefficients of a polynomial. And this is actually the motivation between how we're going to do FFT anyhow, is it's going to be basically polynomial multiplication. And also, here's an example from signal processing for why someone might want to do the FFT. So the example goes like, say you have a sample with endpoints, and since you sampled it from like some real distribution or whatever, it's probably going to be noisy. So if you want to reduce the noise, you might want to average each point in your sample with the neighboring sample. So like say k steps to the left, k steps to the right. So a common thing people do is Gaussian smoothing is an example of the type of averaging you might do. So if you start off with a vector of coefficients ai, you end up with ai prime, where it looks like, so basically you weight the neighbors with a Gaussian. The farther away it is, the less weight it has. And z is just your normalization factor. And so you would define a weight mask, which might look something like that. And for the Gaussian, it would just be like the weights would be the Gaussians, the weights and the weight mask. And then you notice that this looks like what you ultimately want is actually a convolution. And so if you could take these two vectors and apply FFT to them, you would have the transformed vector that you want. So I guess here are the steps in the FFT algorithm. So this is an overview. So the top arrow going from left to right is the ordinary multiplication, how much time it would take. And you start out with a0 to an minus 1, b0 to bn minus 1. So going to the bottom now is what we're going to do is we're going to treat these vectors as coefficients in the polynomial. And then we're going to evaluate the polynomial at these certain special points, omega. And by clever choice of what points we pick, we're going to ensure that this takes n log n time. And now we're working with these polynomials evaluated at points, so not the full polynomial, but the evaluation of them. And you can, of course, multiply a and b to get c. So c is c of x is a of x times b of x. Its coefficients will be the answer that you're seeking. And when you do have points, you can just multiply points, right? So that's easy to do. So that takes time n. And then you want to go back from points to actual coefficients. So that's the interpolation stage. And we're going to see that that also takes time n log n. Right, so the idea is you're going to treat a and b as coefficients of polynomials a of x, b of x, and we want the coefficients of c of x, which will be the product of the two polynomials. So the idea is if we could evaluate these polynomials at specific points, then we would have our target polynomial also evaluated at these specific points, and then we can interpolate back. And by clever choice of points, we can get a speed up. And also, just for the interpolation stage, it's a fact that if you have a polynomial of degree n and you have n plus 1 or more points, that's going to be enough for you to be able to interpolate the coefficients of the polynomial. So first going to the evaluation step. So we're going to do this by clever choice of evaluation points. And basically, we're going to choose roots of unity, specifically 2nth roots of unity. So the reason why 2n is just because c of x has degree, since you're multiplying two polynomials of degree n, so you want 2n. And then so you want to start out with 2n points on each of a and b, even though they're each degree n. And actually note that evaluating a on the root of unity is the same as taking the DFT, right? Because the DFT was a sum over powers of the roots of unity. So basically, if we can do this FFT thing, we automatically have a fast way to compute the DFT. So we're going to start by decomposing a of x into two parts, even and odd, so that we can write it in this way. So a of x is equal to the a even part plus the x times the a odd part. And then we can go ahead and plug in our omegas. And actually, by this point, we've basically already solved the problem. So I guess generally the sort of arguments you make in computer science are if you have a problem and you can reduce it to a problem you've already solved, then you've solved the problem. So in this case, our problem is the a of x. And if we have a even of x squared and a odd of x squared, then we already have a of x. But these are actually just the same problem on a smaller case. So we can recursively do this. So you can start from a base case and then build your solutions for larger n from the, I guess, the smaller half-sized polynomial. So basically, that's how you get the n log n time. And I guess visually, if you consider the stack of function calls you need to make. So the first level, so you have your first level, which is where you start off. And then that has two subcases, which are the even and odd half. And then the even one, in turn, has its own even and odd half. And the odd one, similarly, has its own even and odd half. And so you would just add up the time it takes to do each one. And we know that each level takes time cn. And there, the height of the stack is going to be log n. So that, in total, is going to take n log n time. So this is sort of a classic divide and conquer algorithm, where you have maybe your original problem. You can split it in half into two problems that are the same thing. And you would combine the results of the two halves. And now I'll just talk about how you do the interpolation part. So let's say, OK, you've done your divide and conquer thing, and then you've done the pointwise multiplication on C. So you have all your C of xi. How do you go back to the original polynomial C of x? So this is actually just taking the inverse discrete Fourier transform. And to see this, we can write the original DFT as a y equals vn times a, where vn is the van der Waals matrix, which looks like this. And if you actually do out these the matrix parts, you just see that this is, yeah, this is the discrete Fourier transform. The entries in this matrix are just like your roots to various powers. And so actually, this van der Waals matrix is very easy to invert. And you could actually like do this out, and you would see that the inverse has entries that are given by this. And so that means that the coefficients of C of x are actually going to be this inverse discrete Fourier transform, which actually maybe should have been obvious, because all you're doing is Fourier transforming and then doing the inverse. So this actually means that to do the interpolation, then we just do the DFT again, but we switch what's the coefficient, what's the valuation point, and we switch what power omega is to. So we take it to the minus 1 power. And so this is, again, going to take us time O of n log n. OK, so now I'll talk about the quantum Fourier transform, which takes inspiration from discrete Fourier transform, but really is not the same thing, doesn't do the same thing. So we recall that the DFT maps x to y like this. And now the quantum Fourier transform is almost the same, except instead of taking a list of numbers and giving you back a list of numbers, it maps amplitudes to amplitudes. So what you had before as coefficients are now amplitudes. And in terms of basis vectors, you can also write how it acts on the basis vectors. And also, an equivalent form of the quantum Fourier transform looks like this, which looks kind of cryptic, but you can almost take this as a definition of it as well, of what it does. And just roughly why these two things are equivalent, I guess that's a lot of lines. But basically, it's like if you write it out in binary, like the 0.j1 to jn, where j1 to jn is your basis vector, which is going to be ones and zeros. And I mean, this is in Nielsen and Chuang, so if you're interested. But if you write out the zero and ones, it works out to this, so that these two expressions for the thing are the same. And in terms of implementing it as a quantum circuit, so we see that on your first qubit, you want to first perform a Hadamard transform, and then you want these controlled rotations. So here's the rotation matrix that you're doing. And they're going to be controlled on the other elements of your basis vector, so whether that digit is 0 or 1. And just to see how that might work, so when you first apply the Hadamard to the first qubit, you're going to get something that looks like this. And the 0.j1 just comes from considering whether j1 is 0 or 1. And then you want to apply other rotations as well. And then also depending on whether it's 0 or 1, because you're going to divide by 2 to the power of whatever that is. And then if you So basically, if you just apply these series of rotations to each qubit, you're going to get what's on the right-hand side for each qubit. And then you end up with the product on the bottom here, the last line. So I guess just very quickly, an application for this is phase estimation, which I'm not going to talk about too much. But like if you like say you do have this unitary U that gives you this phase phi, we remember that what the quantum Fourier transform does is it takes this basis vector J1 to JN to this like thing that looks like, okay, a product of superposition with like certain phases. And so the idea behind phase estimation is, what if we could do this backwards? So let's say that you could somehow prepare the state that looks like this, where it has somehow has like, let's say if phi is 0.51 to phi t, then you can somehow get this phase into like the coefficient of 1 over here, and then run it backwards, and then applying the inverse of the quantum Fourier transform would give you this phase. So you can read off phases basically if you have a unitary that gives you a certain phase. And so that's nice, and that's a pretty big deal, and it's a subroutine in a lot of useful quantum algorithms that I'm not going to talk about. But basically, I guess what I was interested in was, okay, so we have this discrete Fourier transform, we have this quantum Fourier transform, which takes inspiration from the discrete Fourier transform, but it doesn't solve that problem, because you're doing the transform on amplitudes, which is not the same thing as like a list of numbers. In particular, like you can't really extract amplitudes, right? And a lot of people doing quantum algorithm stuff, a lot of it is actually about being able to cleverly somehow extract an amplitude that you want. But anyhow, so the running time of the quantum Fourier transform, like if you have n qubits, that's 2 to the n coefficients. So the runtime of this is going to be O of n, or it's going to require O of n squared gates. And the FFT, we said that was n log n, right? Except now we're going to say n is equal to 2 to the n, where n was the number, the size of your list, which for n qubits would be 2 to the n. And so plugging that in, FFT, the classical FFT, would require n times 2 to the n gates. So the question was, could we actually use the quantum Fourier transform to get a faster signal processing algorithm for the classical case? And the answer is probably not. I mean, even if we did manage to somehow find a way that's going to read off the amplitudes, there still are 2 to the n of them. So if you take 2 to the n and multiply that by n squared, that doesn't do any better than your classical case. So I guess mainly I was just curious if people had come up with other ways to do this. Maybe it seems like they haven't really. And so I just ended up making a presentation on, I guess, what the classical FFT looks like, what the quantum Fourier transform looks like. And the two algorithms don't really look anything like each other. But the fact that people were able to take the discrete Fourier transform as inspiration for the quantum Fourier transform, which ends up doing, I guess, a completely different thing, solving a completely different problem in terms of the quantum algorithms that use it, is pretty cool. So yeah, that's my presentation.
Welcome to this talk on the basic introduction to loop quantum gravity. And I hope by the end of this talk, you'll be motivated to pursue research in this very exciting field. Okay. This is the overview of my talk. So why do we need a quantum theory of gravity? In Haranoff's book on quantum paradoxes, he considers a very nice scenario where you prepare a particle in an eigenstate of momentum so that you know the momentum of that particle. Then you try to measure the gravitational force that particle experiences. I'm assuming we are talking in terms of Newton's perspective. In principle, by knowing the force and the momentum, you know the precise position of this particle. And of course, this will violate Heisenberg uncertainty principle. unless, of course, you allow the gravitational field to fluctuate. So from this simple paradox, we see a classical need for a classical, in quotes, quantum theory of gravity. Now, we also expect to get new physics from understanding how to quantize gravity. By this, I mean, take for an example, Einstein's search for a consistent way of unifying Galilean mechanics with Maxwell's electrodynamics. In doing so, he realized that physics at speeds close to the speed of light is quite different from what the speeds we are more or less used to on a daily basis. So if not for this, his brilliant insight to unify these two fields, we would not have had special relativity. So who knows what will come out of having a completely consistent quantum mechanical view of gravity. And of course, for any quantum theory, you expect that the classical limit should give us what we are used to in more or less classical mechanics. So you have to use the Bohr's the correspondence principle, which basically says that the limit that you take your theory to, maybe for example, if you take a semi-classical limit, your quantum theory should give you a classical theory, right? So we expect a quantum theory of gravity to give us classical gravity, so to speak. So for example, and in this case, the classical gravity we are talking about is Einstein's gravity, where gravity is encoded in the geometry of a manifold, which we know as space-time. So then, there are many candidates to to quantizing gravity. I mean, one of them, which you know, is string theory. But there's also another approach, which is loop quantum gravity. It's more modest in its outset, in the sense that, unlike string theory, loop quantum gravity does not seek to unify all the forces of nature, but instead, we just, in loop quantum gravity, want to find a quantum mechanical description of Einstein's gravity. It is background independent. What I mean by this is, for example, in QFT in Kerr space-time, which sort of seems to be like a quantum theory of gravity, you pick your metric as being decomposed to a fixed background plus some perturbation. And of course, these perturbations arise at what's called a graviton. But in loop quantum gravity, we don't have any fixed background. You quantize the full metric. And this is a very powerful attribute of LQG. So why loops? Okay, so in loop quantum cosmology, where it's basically an application of LQG to cosmology, there's an equation known as the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And in this equation, loops of a connection, which by connection, I'm talking about an alternative description of gravity. You can describe, you know, the manifold as a structure, for example, from the covariant derivative. You have this connection that connects different tangent spaces on your manifold, which allows you to do calculus on the manifold. Now, they try to use the idea of Maxwell's theory, where instead of considering the general electric field, for example, you talk about field lines. So you consider the field along discrete paths or lines. In LQG, we also consider these connections, but actually not the exact connection, but a combination of this connection and then the normal curvature, which is basically this is the trace of the normal curvature, which is known as the Azteca connection. I've removed some parameters there, but basically we have the Azteca connection, and you consider this connection along a loop, for example. And it was shown that these loop solutions are very important. They arise as solutions to the Euler-De Witt equation, which is like the Schrodinger equation for quantum gravity. And so that's why we use, that's why we are considering loops. And it was demonstrated that the intersection of these loops to form what you call spin network states, which I'll come to in a bit, is what is needed to get a completely consistent, you know, LQG theory. So how do we proceed with the quantization? We start with an action. The action we're working with is not the first order action, because the F you see there is like a curvature of some connection. I think I actually have it here. And the highest order derivative appearing, so first order, that's why it's called a first order action. Now you see another quantity there known as the triad. Now this one is supposed to approximate this metric. So instead of working with the metric, you work with these triads, parables. And it is completely understood in the literature that they have all the information that this metric has. So you don't lose anything by working with this triad. And the advantage is it's not easy to actually couple gravity to fermions directly, and you can only do so in this formalism. So it's advantageous when you want to look at your quantum theory in terms of its dynamics with matter fields such as fermions. So it's pretty advantageous to start working with these triads. And as you can see here, there are one forms, and then there's also the other connection. There's a connection that I was talking to you about earlier. And then there's also another one form. That's why there's a subscript A or something. The assumption in this talk is that we are working with 2 plus 1 gravity. So in 2 plus 1, we have that, in this case, for example, the A runs from 0, 1, 2. But the manifold we are working with, the space-time manifold, we are going to assume has this topology where it's split into equal time hypersurfaces, which is the sigma cross R. And of course, when you vary this action with respect to, when you vary the action with respect to the triad, you get that F is 0. And when you vary with respect to the connection, you get that dE plus omega, which E is equal to 0. So then the first condition is just basically saying that you have flat connections. And then the next condition is just basically saying that you have a torsionless spacetime. So these are the equations of motion. They are pretty peculiar as equations of motion because there are no time derivatives appearing here. And as a result, they are more of constraints than they are of equations of motion. And so then that's the definition for the F, the curvature of the connection. Now we will define a new variable, which is the E. And the capital E, that's known as, we'll call the flux. It's basically just another way of writing the triad, but with that divisive vector symbol in front. And since we are working with a space-time with a topology of sigma cross R, and it's 2 plus 1, so we have equal time hypersurfaces. So we have this two-dimensional surface here. You have a collection of these and your time. We will consider not the full connection omega defined on the manifold, but then the pullback of omega onto the surface, which we'll, by convention, call A. I'm calling it A because I want to emphasize the relation it has with gauge theories, and this connection is going to be like a gauge potential for us that we are going to work with, and you'll see shortly why this link is very important in LQG. Okay, so now the phase space of our theory is parameterized by this connection and the fluxes. So by definition, they have this Dirac bracket. Like in ordinary quantum mechanics, you have the Poisson bracket between X and P being, say, 1. Right? So then that's the same idea here. But of course, these are fields. So there's this Dirac delta appearing there. And I'll come back to that point soon. In LQG, the basic variables we're working with are the holonomy of the connection and the flux of the triad. OK, so now I have to explain what I mean here. So remember, when you look at the Poisson structure, there's a very annoying Dirac delta symbol appearing there. And recall that I said that we are doing 2 plus 1. So on the surface, basically, just to emphasize what I'm trying to say, this one is that. So in LQG, we don't like this one there. So we want to regularize this Dirac delta. In order to regularize it, recall I said that we are following a program of sort of like what you do in electromagnetism, where you consider in magnetism, for example, you have field lines. So in this case, we will, instead of picking the full connection defined on this hypersurface, we will pick the connection defined along an edge or a line, which we will call the holonomy of that connection. So then we have a discrete quantity as opposed to the continuous connection A. And then we will do this. And we are, in order to regularize the fluxes, since we have done so in along a one-dimensional manifold, sub-manifold, which is the edge, we will also regularize the fluxes also at another edge, which is why it's defined that way. And so you have now these two regularized variables, and those are our basic variables in LQG. Now, the reason we are going through all this trouble is we want to draw a correspondence between our problem of quantizing gravity with that of what is done in lattice gauge theories. And in lattice gauge theories, basically you have a gauge potential and you consider the gauge, the value of the gauge potential, you know, along a lattice. And basically a similar idea is what's being done here. But the other, we are doing it along those edges, gamma, on the hypersurface. And we are doing the dual discretization of the triad along also an edge, because the Dirac delta appearing up there is two-dimensional. If we were doing 3 plus 1, for example, then we would have discretized the gauge potential along an edge, that's the holonomy, and then we would discretize the flux along a surface, which justifies this thing as being like a flux, you know, as a flux to a surface. So that's why I'm using these basic variables. And they have this algebra, which is closed, thankfully. So in order to quantize this algebra, we have to find a representation of the algebra. It's basically a problem of the single particle quantization, where in that case you have, it's similar to that problem. It's not exactly it, sorry. So what's happening here is that in single particle, I'm trying to draw a parallel here. In single particle quantization, you have the Poisson brackets of the position vanishes, and of the momentum also vanishes. And of course, X and P is 1. The Poisson bracket of X and P is 1. So because of these two relations here, you have two pictures. You have the position representation, then you have the momentum representation. In LQG, we only have just the holonomies commuting. And just to emphasize why the holonomies have those indexes M and they are matrix elements, because the gauge potential A, remember, it's a one form, and it is valued in the Lie algebra. So in terms of the generators expressed this way, you can see why it's, when you take the exponential of it, get a group element of the Lie group SU2, which is like the isometric group we have on the, on the hypersurfaces. And in this case, because the holonomies, the Poisson bracket of the holonomies vanishes, it means that we can have a holonomy representation of our quantum theory. But you can see the fluxes, the Poisson bracket of fluxes does not vanish. This means that we can't have like a flux representation. So we have just one unique representation here, which is going to be the holonomy representation, where these holonomies are grouped elements in SU2. Because recall, this is a group, this is a Lie algebra valued connection, and the exponential of it is a group element in SU2. So in order to quantize this theory, we'll promote the holonomies and fluxes to operators. Following, and remember, we are working the holonomy picture because that's the only, in the algebra, this is the only one that commutes with itself. And so we can look for a representation where the operators, the holonomy operators act multiplicatively, and then the fluxes act as derivatives. Just similar to single particle quantization, where you can look at the position representation where the position operator acts multiplicatively, and then the momentum operator acts like a derivative. So with this, having defined these operators, we can construct the Hilbert space. Now, the Hilbert space of LQG has a basis known as which is a span. The Hilbert space of the LQG, sorry, has basis which are made of the spin network basis. Now, these spin network bases are basically, the spin networks are graphs with nodes and then edges. So in 2 plus 1, for example, you can imagine that you have a triangulation on your manifold. And I'll pick one piece, like this triangle. For each triangle, I can associate a node. And this node encodes the area of the triangle. Then I can have a dual edge here. That way, and each of these dual edges encodes the length of the, each of these dual lengths encode the length of this edge. So basically, this is like a trivial example of a spin network, which is basically a graph with edges and nodes, where the nodes have colorings. The edges have spins. That's the spin on the group SU2J, irreducible representations of the group SU2. And then at the nodes, we have intertwiners that intertwine these spins. That finds basically is an invariant subgroup. This is invariant at the SU2 transformation, which puts all these spins together, which is kind of common to what you know in the intertwiners you see in ordinary quantum mechanics of angular momentum. So we have a geometric picture now where to each node we can associate a triangle. If you were in 3 plus 1, then you have a three-dimensional hypersurface. Then for each node, you wouldn't associate a triangle, but you would associate a tetrahedron. And now the node would encode the, sorry, is it visible? Okay, let me draw it. And so now the node will encode the volume of the tetrahedron, and then the links out of the faces of the tetrahedron will encode the area of the faces. So that's how, these are the geometric pictures you can have. And in this spin network, the two nodes there, if it's 2 plus 1, the two nodes there have triangles, and I have identified the links, meaning that it's like picking the two triangles here and here, and identifying these two edges by this link, and I can identify these two edges, and that, so I can put them together, and then I'll get a two-sphere. In the case of 3 plus 1, I'll be identifying the faces of the tetrahedron, and that'll give me a three-sphere. So this is sort of the geometry we have in LQG. And of course, these spin networks, these are a linear combination of loops, where when the loops can overlap to form the nodes, or maybe they can overlap to form non-trivial knots, which then draws a link between knot theory and knot invariance and whatnot. And then with the loops, they are basically like graphs without nodes, and then they since I told you that for a node, the node carries information about, you know, the space you have. So if you have no nodes, then you have no excitations or no space. So in LQG, the quantum numbers we have are the intertwiners at this node, and we have spins that label the links. And the dynamics in this quantum theory is that these numbers will be changing. Okay, so now let's look at some of the observables we have in LQG. So like I said, in 2+1, you are dealing with this picture. So you have an observable talking about the length of the triangles, and then you have the area of the triangle. So we have operators that correspond to that. I'll come back to this. And it has been demonstrated that these observables have discrete spectrum. Our very own Lee Smalling and Carlo Rebelli show that the area operators and the length operator here and the area operator that appears here all have discrete spectrum. And because of this, it means that the physics is that you are dealing with quanta of excitation. So space is in quanta. So at the quantum level, you have chunks of space. So you have chunks of these. If you are in 2+1, then you have chunks of these triangles. Or if you are in 3+1, you have chunks of polyhedra that somehow come together and form in the classical limits, your continuous, for example, Minkowski spacetime, which is not actually quite clear yet how you can get classical gravity from quantum, but I'll come there shortly. Okay. So that's the messy parameter, which you don't have to worry about it now. So yeah, basically, this is the geometric picture we have, or the understanding we have of gravity, where for if you have a triangulation on a surface, you can have a non-trivial triangulation. And so, like I said, I'm just repeating. So you have an example of a spin network, and this one tells you the adjacency of the quanta or the excitations, where if two nodes are connected, then the triangles, in the case of 2+1, then the triangles they represent are adjacent to each other, and they are connected by this link, which measures the length, gives you the length of the connecting boundary. Or in the case of a polyhedra, in the case of these and tetrahedra, you have that it gives you the area of the faces, and then the nodes can code the volume. So in summary, we looked at why we need a quantum theory of gravity. We looked at the first order action, identified the basic variables in LQG, and the, okay, since I might have skipped the states. Yeah, so for the states of LQG, remember from the equation of motion we had, I said that each of the links here carry a representation of SU2. And these nodes might be invariant under the action of SU2. So your Hilbert space of our theory should be SU2 L quotiented by SU2 at the nodes. What this basically means is that you are dealing with square integrable functions of the group SU2. So your wave function, just as in position representation, you have a wave function of x. Now we have a wave function of the holonomy. And so if you have a spin network this way, with a holonomy here, another holonomy there, for example, then your wave function will be a function of all of these holonomies. And it's like a tensor, and each of them is like its own Hilbert space of SU2. And this way, so it's like a tensor product of each of these Hilbert spaces. So you are dealing with basically a Hilbert space of functionals of a group. And of course, you wonder if you can define a measure on this group. Fortunately, the group you are working with, which is SU2, is a compact group, and there's a canonical measure we can define on it, which is the Ha measure. So in summary, we have that L2 quotiented by SU2 and with this measure defined. And so our states in LQG are functions of the holonomy that are gauge invariant, absolute invariant under SU2 transformation. So they must satisfy the constraints that we saw earlier, which is the flatness constraint and then the Gauss constraint, where the Gauss constraint simply means that they must be invariant under SU2 transformation. Okay. So, thank you. Okay. Questions, please.
I have no chance.
Quantum gravity.
Is there any condition that it has, like, there's no dependence on the triangulation, right? So it should.
And yes, thank you for the question. I forgot to mention one of the open problems in LQG now is we don't completely understand what happens to the triangulation as you have the few quantum dynamical theory. For example, in relation to yours, it hasn't yet been proven that it's independent of the triangulation you choose. But we expect it to be so, I mean, physically, because, more so to taking something like a continuum limit is not really clear. Like, as in lattice gauge theory, you just take the limits where the edges go to zero dimension, right? But it's not really clear how to do so in LQG. So, as part of my project, I'm working on constructing coherent states in LQG so that we can better understand the semi classical limits of the theory and see if it can hint or point to it. Way to better understand the continuum limit, which is closely tied into whether or not, indeed, defining the spin networks this way is independent of the triangulation you choose. Physically, we expect it. Mathematically, it's not been proven yet. Sorry.
Okay, it looks like Eugene and all.
Thank you.